Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners. Hello and welcome to As It Is Sunday. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. On today's show, we will learn a little about the history of Chinese dance places in the United States. During the 1950s and 60s, Chinese American nightclubs on the U.S. West Coast were as important as they were popular. These nightclubs broke down racial barriers. They also led the way for Asian actors to enter the U.S. entertainment industry. Anna Mateo brings you this story today. But first, here are some words that may help you understand the story more fully. A marquee is a sign over the entrance to a theater that shows the name of the show and the names of the performers. Subjects that are taboo are not acceptable to talk about or do. Lastly, a bigot is a person who hates or refuses to accept the members of a particular group. And now, here's Anna.
In the 1930s, Asian American performers did not have many opportunities in mainstream U.S. entertainment. These performers were limited to roles that simply made fun of their cultural heritage. But in the 1940s and 50s, opportunities for Asian American performers began to change. Chinese American nightclubs in California permitted singers, dancers, and actors to overcome racial and cultural barriers and follow their dreams. In 1989, filmmaker Arthur Dong captured that little-known part of entertainment history in his film, Forbidden City, USA. The film has now been remade in a digital format, and Mr. Dong has turned his research into a new book. A man named Arthur Dong grew up in San Francisco, California. As a young Chinese-American boy in the 1950s and 60s, he walked by a nightclub in Chinatown, a neighborhood where many Chinese people lived. He says he remembers walking past the nightclub's marquees, or displays. They showed pictures of the performers wearing elegant gowns and tuxedos. This made quite an impression on the little boy. Here is Arthur Dong.
And I remember distinctly looking at the marquee and looking at the glass display case, all these wonderful black and white photos of Chinese people, but dressed in zoot suits and 1940s kind of gowns and tuxedos. And I had never seen Chinese dressed like that.
The nightclub was called Forbidden City, the same name as the Imperial Palace in China. It opened in 1938 and became very popular. But in 1989, when Mr. Dong decided to make a documentary film about Forbidden City and other Chinese American nightclubs, few of the people who remembered those nightclubs wanted to talk about them. Mr. Dong says people felt uncomfortable. They were ashamed of the clubs, mainly because the women performers wore very little clothing. In other words, they were scantily dressed. For the conservative Chinese community of that time, he says, the subject of the clubs was taboo, something people did not want to talk about. Conservative Chinese parents also did not want their children to become entertainers. According to Mai Tai Singh, performing was not a high-class job. She says it was considered low-grade. Mai Tai Singh was part of a younger generation that became entertainers anyway. She started out as a chorus girl in the early 1940s.
Well, this young lady knows exactly where she is going. She is one of the dancing stars of Charlie Lowe's fabulous Forbidden City in San Francisco. Her name is Mai Tai Singh, and she's America's most beautiful Chinese entertainer.
Mai Tai Singh is now 91 years old and lives in Hawaii. She recalls the golden age of Forbidden City. She says the nightclub had it all. Dancers, comedians, and singers like Larry Ching, who was called the Chinese Frank Sinatra.
I'll fade to true. Somewhere there's heaven, how high the moon.
You are listening to As It Is. After a short break, we will continue with the story of Chinese nightclubs in America. Welcome back. Today on As It Is, we are exploring the history of Chinese-American nightclubs in the U.S. We hear how these places helped Asian performers in their careers in the entertainment industry. Ana Mateo continues with this story.
Forbidden City, the nightclub, not the Imperial Palace, was even featured in major U.S. media outlets, including Life magazine. In its heyday, major U.S. celebrities like Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, and Duke Ellington came to see shows there. But the club's popularity did not protect the performers from racial comments made by a mostly white audience. This is according to a writer and broadcaster named Ben Fong Torres.
So even though you are the stars of the show, they still feel superior to you and make remarks, racist remarks, to your face or shout it out from the audience. And I think that was pretty difficult for most of these entertainers to take. But as Larry Ching said, I had to, otherwise I wouldn't be in the business.
Mr. Fong Torres says that over time, Asian American nightclubs changed people's minds and attitudes about Asian Americans. He says the clubs also shattered conceptions, a common expression that means to change a person's thoughts about something. Singer Jimmy Borges remembers one evening.
And I was singing Fever. Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. You give me fever. And this lady, she was looking at me, and there was this look in her eye of complete mystification. And she says to her husband, she nudges him with her elbow. She says, "Oh, Charlie, he sings just like a white man." And that was so funny, because she didn't mean it in a bad way. She meant it like she had never seen anybody like me sing a song that was made famous by a white person.
Some Forbidden City performers went on to become famous in American television and movies. Filmmaker Arthur Dong says the early nightclub performers continue to inspire young Asian Americans today.
They knew what they wanted. They had dreams. They had goals. And they weren't going to let larger societal bigotry get in their way. And they had fun doing it.
I'm Ana Mateo.
Listeners, as of June 7th, Learning English programs will no longer be heard on VOA's medium wave radio station in Bangkok. But you will still be able to listen to our programs on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com, and on podcasts from iTunes.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
now the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Whoa, boy. Today we tell all about horse expressions. In the past, many people depended on horses for transportation, farming, and other kinds of work. A lot of people still like to ride horses for sport. Horse racing and betting on horse racing are also popular. So it is not surprising that Americans use a lot of expressions about horses. Long ago, people who were rich or important rode horses that were very tall. Today, if someone acts better than everyone else, you might tell him to get off your high horse. And if someone is pushing you to do something, you can say, "Hold your horses." This is a very informal way to tell someone to calm down and wait. You would not use it with your boss, but you could use it with children. Something else you could say to children if they are playing too rough or hitting each other is to stop horsing around. When kids horse around, they could get hurt. However, kids who live in a one-horse town might have nothing to do but horse around. A one-horse town is a small town with not too much going on. So if you live in a one-horse town, you might like to watch a lot of television. Imagine that you are watching your favorite show when your phone rings. You do not answer it. Wild horses could not drag you away from the television. Nothing could stop you from doing what you want to do. In fact, that's what the Rolling Stones are singing about in their song Wild Horses.
'Cause wild horses couldn't drag me away.
If you love someone, even strong wild horses could not drag you away from that person. When you get news directly from the best source, you get it straight from the horse's mouth. If your teacher, for example, tells you there is going to be a test tomorrow, you got that information straight from the horse's mouth. Don't worry, this is not the same as saying your teacher has a horse face. Sometimes a person keeps arguing a question that has already been settled. They are beating a dead horse. A dead horse is quite different from a dark horse. A dark horse is a person who surprises others by doing better than expected. In politics, a dark horse candidate is someone who is not likely to win, but then does. A horse of a different color is a different matter entirely. For example, you and your friend might be talking about how to make more money. Your friend suggests investing in the stock market. You mention betting at the racetrack. Gambling, your friend says, that's a horse of a different color. In other words, it's a different way of thinking about the same topic. Your friend might use another horse expression to give you some advice. If she tells you, "Do not put the cart before the horse," she is telling you to do things in the proper order. Here's another piece of advice. Do not change horses in midstream. You would not want to make major changes to something you've already started. In the past, this expression was used as an argument to re-elect a president, especially during a time when the country was at war. And one more piece of advice from the world of horses is if you fall off the horse, get right back on again. When you fail or suffer a setback, it is important to try again. But people often ignore good advice. After all, you can lead a horse to water, but you cannot make it drink. This means you can give someone advice, but you cannot force them to use it. I'm Anna Mateo.
I'm Steve Ember.
And I'm Barbara Klein with People in America in VOA Special English. Today, we tell about Wilma Rudolph, the first American woman to win 3 gold medals in 1 Olympics.
They called her the Black Pearl, the Black Gazelle, and the fastest woman in the world. In 1960, Wilma Rudolph became the first American woman to win 3 gold medals in 1 Olympics. She was an extraordinary American athlete. She also did a lot to help young athletes succeed. Wilma Rudolph was born in 1940 in St. Bethlehem, Tennessee. She was born too early and only weighed 2 kilograms. She had many illnesses when she was very young, including pneumonia and scarlet fever. She also had polio, which damaged her left leg. When she was 6 years old, she began to wear metal leg braces because she could not use that leg.
Wilma Rudolph was born into a very large, poor African-American family. She was the 20th of 22 children. Since she was sick most of the time, her brothers and sisters all helped to take care of her. They took turns rubbing her crippled leg every night. They also made sure she did not try to take off her leg braces. Every week, Wilma's mother drove her to a special doctor 80 kilometers away. Here, she got physical treatments to help heal her leg. She later said, "My doctors told me I would never walk again. My mother told me I would. I believed my mother."
Soon, her family's attention and care showed results. By the time she was 9 years old, she no longer needed her leg braces. Wilma was very happy because she could now run and play like other children. When she was 11 years old, her brothers set up a basketball hoop in the backyard. After that, she played basketball every day. As a teenager, Wilma joined the girls' basketball team at Burt High School. C.C. Gray was the coach who supervised the team. He gave her the nickname Skeeter. She did very well in high school basketball. She once scored 49 points in 1 game, which broke the Tennessee state record. Many people noted that Wilma was a very good basketball player and a very good athlete. One of these people was Ed Temple, who coached the track team of runners at Tennessee State University. Ed Temple asked C.C. Gray to organize a girls' track team at the high school. He thought Wilma Rudolph would make a very good runner. She did very well on the new track team.
Wilma Rudolph went to her first Olympic Games when she was 16 years old and still in high school. She competed in the 1956 Games in Melbourne, Australia. She was the youngest member of the United States team. She won a bronze medal, or 3rd place, in the sprint relay event. In 1957, Wilma Rudolph entered Tennessee State University, where she joined the track team. The coach, Ed Temple, worked very hard for the girls on the team. He drove them to track competitions and made improvements to the running track with his own money. However, he was not an easy coach. For example, he would make the members of the team run one extra time around the track for every minute they were late to practice. Wilma Rudolph trained hard while in college. She did very well at her track competitions against teams from other colleges. In 1960, she set the world record for the fastest time in the 2,000-meter event. She said, "I ran and ran and ran every day, and I acquired this sense of determination, this sense of spirit, that I would never, never give up, no matter what else happened."
That same year, Wilma Rudolph went to the Olympics again, this time in Rome, Italy. She won 2 gold medals, first place in the 100-meter and the 200-meter races. She set a new Olympic record of 23.2 seconds for the 200-meter dash. Her team also won the gold medal in the 400-meter sprint relay event, setting a world record of 44.5 seconds. These 3 gold medals made her one of the most popular athletes at the Rome Games. These victories made people call her the world's fastest woman.
Following a stunning victory in the 100 meters final in a time of 11 seconds, which would have been a world record but for the wind speed, Rudolph destroyed the field in the 200 meters to claim her 2nd gold medal.
Wilma Rudolph received a lot of attention from the press and the public, but she did not forget her teammates. She said that her favorite event was the relay because she could share the victory with her teammates, Martha Hudson, Lucinda Williams, and Barbara Jones. All 4 women were from Tennessee State University. The Associated Press named Rudolph the U.S. Female Athlete of the Year. She also appeared on television many times. Sports fans in the United States and all over the world loved and respected her. She said, "The feeling of accomplishment welled up inside of me, 3 Olympic gold medals. I knew that was something nobody could ever take away from me, ever."
Wilma Rudolph was a fine example for many people inside and outside the world of sports. She supported the civil rights movement, the struggle for equality between white and black people. When she came home from the Olympics, she told the governor of Tennessee that she would not attend a celebration where white and black people were separated. As a result, her homecoming parade and dinner were the first events in her hometown of Clarksville that white people and black people were able to attend together. After she retired from sports, Wilma Rudolph completed her education at Tennessee State University. She got her bachelor's degree in elementary education and became a teacher. She returned to coach the track team at Burt High School. She also worked as a commentator for women's track competitions on national television. In 1963, she married her high school boyfriend, Robert Eldridge. They had 4 children, but later ended their marriage. Wilma Rudolph won many important athletic awards. She was voted into the Black Athletes Hall of Fame and the United States Olympic Hall of Fame. She was also voted into the National Track and Field Hall of Fame. In 1977, she wrote a book about her life called Wilma. She wrote about her childhood problems and her athletic successes. NBC later made the book into a movie for television.
Rudolph said her greatest success was creating the Wilma Rudolph Foundation in 1981. This organization helped children in local communities to become athletes. She always wanted to help young athletes recognize how much they could succeed in their lives. She said, "The triumph can't be had without the struggle, and I know what struggle is. I have spent a lifetime trying to share what it has meant to be a woman first in the world of sports so that other young women have a chance to reach their dreams." Rudolph also influenced many athletes. One of them was another African-American runner, Florence Griffith Joyner. In 1988, Griffith Joyner became the second American woman to win 3 gold medals in 1 Olympics. She went on to win a total of 6 Olympic medals. Wilma Rudolph was very happy to see other African-American female athletes succeed. She said, "I thought I'd never get to see that. Florence Griffith Joyner, every time she ran, I ran."
Wilma Rudolph died of brain cancer in 1994 in Nashville, Tennessee. She was 54 years old. She influenced athletes, African Americans, and women around the world. She was an important example of how anyone can overcome barriers and make their dreams come true. Her 1960 Olympics teammate, Bill Mullican, said, "She was beautiful, she was nice, and she was the best."
This program was written by Aaron Braswell and produced by Katie Weaver. I'm Barbara Klein.
And I'm Steve Ember. You can learn more about famous Americans at our website, voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for People in America in VOA Special English.